you'll see in Perek Lamed Tet Pasuk Chaf, Vayikach Adonai Yosef Oto Vayitnehu El Beit HaSohar. Where is Yosef now in Perek Lamed Tet Pasuk Chaf? Where is he? Beit HaSohar. Keep going. What is the Beit HaSohar? Mekom Asher Asirei HaMelech Asurim. Vayihi Sham. Where was Yosef? Beit HaSohar. Anybody have any questions where Yosef was found at the time? Where was he sent when he gets to Mitzrayim? Anybody? Anybody? Beit HaSohar. It's right here. Next. Vayihi Hashem et Yosef. Vayet Elav Chesed. Vayitain Chino Be'enei Sar Beit HaSohar. Three times in two psukim. Where's Yosef found? Where's Yosef found? Beit HaSohar. Chafbet. Vayitain Sar Beit HaSohar. Biyad Yosef. Et kol ha'asirim asher beveit ha'sohar. Ve'et kol asher osim sham hu haya oseh. Chaf gimel. Ein sar beit ha'sohar. Ro'e et kol me'uma biyado. Ba'asher Hashem ito. Va'asher hu oseh Hashem matzliach. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times in 4 psukim. I'm in Perek Lamed Tet psukim chaf through chaf gimel. 6 times in 4 psukim do we have Yosef's location identified. Where is Yosef found? Say it out. Beit HaSohar. Skip now to Perek Mem. I'm in Vayeshev. Skip now to Perek Mem, Pasuk Aleph. Vayihi achar hadvarim ha'ele chat'u mashke melech Mitzrayim. V'ha'ofel Adonaihem le'melech Mitzrayim. V'ikzov par al sar paro al shnei sarisav al sar mashkim v'al sar ha'ofim. V'yiten otam b'mishmar beit sar ha'tabachim el beit ha'sohar. Mekom asher Yosef asur sham, etc. Mekom asher Yosef asur sham. Where is Yosef found? Anybody? Beit ha'sohar. Does anybody have any doubts as to where Yosef is located in Mitzrayim? Where is he found? Beit HaSohar. Yosef is sent to jail. It's a modern Hebrew word for jail. The modern Hebrew word comes from the Tanakh word. He's in jail. It's a dungeon. He's in jail and he's in there for 2 years. For the last time, where is Yosef found? Beit HaSohar. And now we turn to the beginning of our parsha. Yosef for 2 years is stuck, and finally, literally through an act of a miracle, through an act of God, Yosef is discovered. The Sarah Ofim, long gone, 2 years ago, was killed. Sarah Mashkim has been holding the secret in his mind for 2 years. Finally, the Sarah Mashkim wakes up. He remembers this Jew in the Beit HaSohar, that he has some kind of gift, telling dreams, explaining dreams, solving dreams. And Paro says, get him! Pasuk in Perek Mem Aleph, our Parsha, Perek Yudalid. Vayishlach Paro vayikra et Yosef vayiritzuhu mi Beit HaSohar. Do you have that pasuk in front of you? Look in front of you. Let's read the words closely. Vayishlach paro. Vayikrat Yosef vayiritzu min beit ha'sohar. Did I read the pasuk properly?
No.
What are you talking about? Did anybody have any doubt where Yosef was? Where was Yosef found? Beit ha'sohar. So why does the pasuk not say Mem Aleph, Yud Dalid? Vayishlach paro vayikrat Yosef. Vayiritzu mi beit ha'sohar. Is that where they saved Yosef from? Vayiritzu mi nabor. Ladies, what do you know about Tanakh and the story of Yosef? When was Yosef in a bor? When his brothers put him there. For years, Yosef has been holding on to himself, trying to keep things together, The world is crumbling beneath his feet. Every time things seem to be going well, he's thrown backwards. Yosef is still in the boar. Sure, he's physically in the Beit HaSoar, but Yosef is still in the boar. His brother still threw him in the pit. His father still sent him to go see how they're doing, knowing full well, V'aviv shamar tadavar, knowing full well that his brothers hate him, that his brothers feel distant. And yet, with all his travels, whether he's high up in Paro's home, whether he's low down in the Beit HaSoar, Yosef is still in the boar. And the only time he gets out is through an act, a snap your fingers, supernatural event. By every measure, Yosef was supposed to die in that Beit HaSoar. And yet, miraculously, Yosef finds himself saved. And it is the first time in all these years that Yosef comes out of the boar. It's the first time that he's able to depart and see himself as anything other than the hated brother and the brother whose own family tried to kill. This is part one. Part one is one way to respond to crisis, one way to respond to challenging times, and that is to wait for a miracle. That's exactly what happened. Yosef was found in a crisis. And the only way he was able to pick himself up was really by somebody else picking him up. Paro b'derech hateva, Hashem me'al hateva v'yiritzu min habor. There is another way to get out of a crisis. And I'd like to share this other way with you, also in our parsha. And I'd like to end, we started a little bit late and I'm going to have to go a little bit quickly, but I'd like to end by sharing a personal story that can maybe shed light on these two ways. Go now in Perek, in Miketz, turn now in your Tanakh to Perek Membet. And let's start in Pasuk Aleph. Vayar Yaakov. So let's remember where we are. Yosef is long dead as far as Yaakov is concerned. Egypt experiences its most phenomenal economic development, but thanks to the genius who actually takes no credit for himself, thanks to the help of God, Egypt manages to plan ahead. The good times are not always going to be here. The stock market may go down. The futures market, especially the wheat futures, are looking bleak. And Yosef, second in command, finance minister, decides to arrange for some austerity measures to make sure that we can ride out the dark times. And such happens. As great as the great years were, that's how terrible and even worse the bad years are. But not to worry, fear not. Yosef takes care of it, and Mitzrayim is fine. However, not all is fine everywhere. The Jewish clan, the Jewish family in Eretz Kanaan is not faring well. And says Yaakov in the beginning of Perek Membet, Vayar Yaakov ki yeshever b'mitzrayim, Vayomer Yaakov levanav lama titra'u, Vayomer hine shamati ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim, Redu shama, V'shivru lanu misham, V'nichye v'lo namut. Shever, shever, shivru. Yaakov realizes that there is shever there. Pasuk Gimel, Vayirdu achei Yosef asara lishbor bar mimitzrayim. Shever bar. Some of you may be familiar with a store in town called Hamash Beer. Hamash Beer. That's when eventually next week, when Yaakov finally gets together or hears about Yosef living, he finds out that not only is Yosef alive, he is the Mashbir. He feels he's the one who causes Shever to be had. He feeds the world. Keep going. Dalid. Vet Binyamin achi Yosef lo shalach Yaakov et echav ki yamar pen yikrenu ason pasuk hey vayavo bnei Yisrael lishbor betoch habaim ki hayah ra'av be'eretz Kanaan. Here we go, Shever again, next. V'yosef hu ha-shalit al ha'aretz hu ha-mashbir l'chol ha'am ha'aretz. Yosef is the mashbir. Skipping to the end of Pasuk Zayin. V'yomer elehem me'ayin batem v'yomru me'eretz Kanaan lishbor ochel. Nothing strange here. We need food. There's no food here. There is food there. I heard that there's food there. Go there and get food. Okay. We find ourselves at the second method of dealing with a crisis. None of you own homes. Many of your parents do. And you can imagine one day you come down, excuse me, into the living room, and you notice that there's a tiny little problem in the wall, like a little crack in the wall in the living room. So you do what everybody does, and that is you put a picture over the wall, over the crack. It'll probably go away, don't worry. And then you realize, well, that's a supporting wall. Do you know what a supporting wall is? That's the wall, one of the walls that really literally holds up the house. But you kind of let it go and let it go until the crack starts coming out from outside of the picture. So you do what everybody is supposed to do. They take the picture and they turn it portrait. And every time people come into the house, oh, is that your grandmother? Oh, is that? But at least you're covering the crack, not to worry. But at some point, the crack gets bigger and bigger, and you gotta call the handyman, a construction person. You gotta face the fact that there's a problem in the house. And the person comes and they say, this is a problem. It's too bad you didn't come to me earlier, but you did what everybody else did. You took a picture and then you turned the picture. But this is a crack in the foundation of the house. And if you don't fix this, the house will crumble. So your first reaction, you're probably angry at the construction worker. What kind of chutzpah? My house is strong. I've lived here. I've raised a family here. My parents were here. Then you're angry. Then you call another construction person, obviously, and they tell you the same thing. Then you're angry because you have to spend, you know, 50,000 shekel to literally redo the whole foundation of the house, maybe more. But at some point, you become grateful that it's only 50,000 shekel and not, you know, X times that amount if, God forbid, the entire house comes down. You actually, there's a certain level of gratitude. Hopefully we should get to that level. We should never have this problem. But if we do, we should get to the level where, thank you. Baruch Hashem, I caught it now, and not when it could have been much, much, much worse. Chas v'shalom. But the only way that you are able to deal with it is when you recognize that the crack in the wall is problematic. When you deny that crack in the wall, then life was good. But it really was not good. The foundations were crumbling. Yaakov Avinu, all along, knew that something wasn't right. You remember what we read a few days ago? When they came back, the brothers came back with their bloody coats. He's dead. Let's move on. Remember that? Yaakov Avinu refused. And Yaakov Avinu realized that something's not right. It's too convenient. Yosef goes to the middle of nowhere with people who literally hate him and want to kill him. And before you know it, a boy who grew up outdoors. I'm not talking about me, I'm afraid of a snake. But these a boy with all his brothers growing up outdoors. Never got a scratch as far as we know. Very careful about how he looked. Very careful about how he acted. And without a single witness, dead. Something's not right. He couldn't be consoled. So Yaakov says it's time to face the crisis. It's time to face the problem head on. I have a crack in my wall. Shamati, says Yaakov, ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim. There is a crack that I have to address head on. How do you say a crisis in Hebrew? A mashber. A mashber is the breaking point. A mashber is this crack. And the only way to face and to deal with this mashber is to recognize that it's not only shever, a crack, but it is also shamati ki yeshever b'mitzrayim. It is the only way we're going to survive. It is our very food. It's our very sustenance. It's the very thing that is going to enable us to move on. I can't move on like this anymore. There is shever b'mitzrayim. There's not only food and sustenance in Mitzrayim, there's also a crack. And we face that mashber head on. That is the other way, perhaps, excuse me, to address crises. One way is to wait for a miracle, and we as Jews wait for miracles. But we also, at some point, have to face the crack. At some point, we also have to ourselves do the hishtadlut. Miracles happen when we take away the picture, this nice, nice, fancy, schmancy picture we have in front of the crack. Everything's fine. We've got to go into the roots. And that is, of course, connected, of course, in many ways to Hanukkah, in that Hanukkah, as you heard a moment ago, you've been hearing a lot about Yaf Elokim LeYefet. We fought a people that only looked at externals. We fought a people, both physically and spiritually. Rav Kook actually says that, despite all the other Divrei Torah we heard, Rav Kook says that the ultimate fight of Hanukkah is really for the spirit. You can't see a spirit. It's for the spirit of the Jew. And it was the Greeks who cared about externals. What does the body look like? Beauty. We don't say that that's necessarily wrong. We say it's necessarily wrong when that's all there is. Shamati ki yeshever b'mitzrayim. Our job is to look at the crack. Take away the picture, take away the nice wallpaper, and if there's a crack, and God willing there isn't, but if there is, we face it head on. And I wanted to share with you a personal story that happened to me. I'll try to say it quickly. That's related to this idea that you and I are living every single day. We're living in a country, and I wish I remembered who said it. Somebody may remember who said it. It may have been David Ben-Gurion, but I'm not positive he said it, that in order to live in Israel, in order to be a realist in Israel, you have to believe in miracles. Or living in Israel, when you believe in miracles, you're the realist. And we talked about this last night in this very room, during a beautiful chagiga that you guys created, Baruch Hashem, and it's one of the places recently where I lost my voice. We live in a country that is based on miracles. Period. There's no way around it. But we also live in a country where we have to, so to speak, create those miracles and create the hishtadlut to face the troubles head on. When you live in Chutz La'aretz, you don't have to worry about how to have police officers working on Shabbat. That's not a problem we need to deal with. We have to deal with a Knesset that has people that you may not agree with, politically, religiously, personally. There's Arabs in the Knesset that vote on everything, such as who's a Jew. It's incredible. And yet we deal with it head on. Not always easy. It's not always fun to see a crack in the wall. But the more we shamati ki yeshever b'mitzrayim, the more we face the crises of this country, the more we will get ultimately to the ultimate geula, we believe. One of the flashpoints of the hishtadlut versus miracles is, of course, the Israeli army. Certain communities, certain philosophies, certain families, I myself, so far one son, hopefully none of my other children will have to, had to balance between learning and serving. And many of your teachers have children, Diane, many of your teachers have children who would have much rather gone straight to university or stayed in yeshiva or both. But we have to face the fact that there's a hishtadlut that needs to happen. And it's challenging. It's uplifting. You meet all sorts of Jews. All sorts of Jews. You meet some non-Jews serving in the army. One of my many conversations I had with Sneer a few days ago was about the realization that I had when I was in the army. And I'm embarrassed now to say that it didn't really hit me. I wish it did. Of course I know that every Jew is important, and of course I know that every Jew means something, and I know that many Jews love Israel, regardless whatever they're wearing on their head, and sometimes they're not wearing anything. But it took me a while to realize that there were people who, I'm not God, so I don't know who's religious and who's not, but there were certainly seem to be people who were externally not yet observant. And they added on to their army service so that they can be officers defending a state, enabling you and me to learn here. That was eye-opening for me. So I wanted to share with you a specific story that happened to me, speaking of the army and Hanukkah and crises and challenges that happened to me on Hanukkah in the army. I'll try to say it quickly because, again, we're running out of time. You don't remember this. You weren't alive. Maybe you read about it. But there was a very scary event that happened a little bit before Hanukkah in 1987. And to make a long story short, there was a hang glider that came into Israel. He came under the radars. Now we have the capabilities to recognize hang gliders. He came into Israel. He infiltrated a base on the Syrian border. And he killed, I think one soldier, he himself was killed, and it was a very, very difficult time for the state of Israel, the impenetrable army that was still excited from 1967 and 1973, that suffered somewhat of a setback in 1981. Here was another crack in the holy armor of the IDF, and it became clear that Syria either funded this terrorist or helped him, and the nation was going to war. Now, if you know your history, there was no war. But when you're living history, you didn't know the end of the story. So the day after that event, my unit was sent up to the Syrian border. And in those days, it's not true anymore, but in those days, I was in the tank unit. I was a I served in a tank unit, and to serve in a tank unit, you have to wear a full-bodied fiberglass suit. Full-bodied fiberglass suit, and it has a hood, and it has a mask where you put your mask. It has gloves, long sleeves, and we practiced. You can sit in a burning tank for 9 seconds. Nothing happened to you, but you only have 9 seconds. So we practiced over and over and over getting out of a tank within 9 seconds. In the night, in the day, in the wet, in the cold, in the warm, in the heat, tired, not tired, over and over and over. And as a tank gunner, I was a tank gunner, I sat all the way in the middle of the tank. So I had to, as soon as we got the order and it happened any time, I had to disconnect. You know, our helmets had a communication system, so I disconnected the communication system, grab my gun, jump out, you know, go away, all these procedures, you come back in. Sometimes literally 10 seconds, everyone says, you know, over the internal communications, are you there, are you there, yes, yes. Boom, we had to jump out again. It was really, really hard. On one of those occasions, I actually needed some plastic surgery because of I fell. My war injuries. You know, I'd like to make the story better, but I literally just fell. In those days, you were not allowed to get injured. If you got injured, you got punished. So I didn't want to admit that I got hurt, but yet I was bleeding down my shirt. And it's a long story. I stood at attention. The sergeant called me out, and I stand at attention. He says, "Goldschmidt, were you hurt?" And I said, "No, sir, that wasn't the truth, and you should not emulate that behavior," but I did not want to get in trouble. And he walks over to me, and he takes his finger, and he wipes it across my chin, and he goes, "I'll ask you again." Okay, but anyway, in those days, I wore that suit once. I put it on, it fit, they made me like run a little bit, it fit. Good, we don't have enough money for you to practice in that suit. So you're gonna wrap it up and put it in a plastic bag. It's basically like a very good Ziploc bag. Keep it until war. And we practiced every other time, literally in the middle of the summer, with long sleeves and hats to practice what it was like to run around. But we never, ever, ever took that suit out until we were on the bus on the way to the Syrian border. We're already a little scared, you know, because we're heading to the Syrian border. We weren't entirely clear how much war was imminent until on the bus we were told, take out, it's called a sarbal, take out your sarbal and put it on. So to change clothes on a bus may be strange in another circumstance. This was not strange. This was terrifying, because we felt that we were going to war, that we were told that the only time you put that on was going to war, and we literally were told to put them on now. We were petrified, and anybody who says that they were not scared is either stupid or lying. I mean, they're human beings. It was terrible. Anyway, we go to the Syrian border, and again, the first few days was very hectic and very, I'll tell you a story another time about, it was hard. The story that Rabbi Israel told the other night about not showering for 5 weeks was because of this. Because we didn't have enough time to shower. We were so much on edge, and the edge. We were 2 kilometers from the Syrian border. We were able to recognize through our binoculars the Syrian soldiers that were opposite us. We gave them names. They had a dog. One of the posts had a dog. We called the dog a name, whatever it was. We were that close. And we were always doing maneuvers to practice, not only to practice, but also to show the Syrians that we were serious. And so we had to, from whatever we were doing, eating, sleeping, davening, we had to be inside a moving tank within 2 minutes. Imagine here, 2 minutes. You got to get into full battle gear, full into a tank, turn it on, everybody's there, all the checks, and drive out. There's no time for anything. Of course, no time for showering. There was more than one occasion where we were in the middle of davening, and we were told to run into the tank, and I kept my tefillin on, and we were driving and driving, and somebody saw me, you know, the loader saw me, said, "Take off your tefillin." You know, "Why do you take off your tefillin?" I said, "If we're going to war, I want my tefillin on." I really said that. It was so tough. So scary. And morale, I have to say, was a little bit low because we were always on edge. People sometimes squabbled with each other, some fighting a little bit. Very scary, very nervous. Again, the end of the story is fine. We're here, there was no war. But, you know, in history, you learn about, well, the causes of war were X, Y, Z. There were no causes. It could happen in a minute. It could happen in 5 minutes. It could happen in an hour. And all these maneuvers and the way we were dressed, it was really scary. Anyway, the base that we were on was a tiny base, just us. We made our own food. We did everything ourselves. We got, once a week, we got an armored personnel carrier escorted a water truck and escorted, like, that had food for us for the week. And it would come into the base, and we would climb up to the top of this, like, maybe two-story water tower, fill up the water, give us the food we needed, goodbye, see you later. And we didn't pay attention to the fact that we didn't prepare for Hanukkah, we didn't get Chanukiyot. And we were in trouble, and we put in an order, but it wasn't going to come until Hanukkah had started already. So we were a little bit concerned. Anyway, the nervousness, morale was low. Our memem, Mifaked Machlaka, the one who was in charge of these few tanks, and that's all we were, decided to do something to boost morale. I left out one detail. We were under strict orders at night to have absolutely no light. Everything on our uniform that was silver was blackened over. On, when you're on duty, in other words, not just waiting, but you're on duty, face painted. People who smoked, they shouldn't have, but if they did, they were not allowed to smoke outdoors because we were trying to really keep procedures that no one should know where we are. They knew where we were, but for some reason, everything had to be pitch black. Also led to the scariness. Anyway, to the fear. Anyway, so our officer decided to do something to boost morale. A tank shoots these huge shells, like this big. The top half goes out to its target, and the bottom half, this canister that's open on one side, gets shot out the back of the gun. Yeah, I guess it's called a shell, because it's a shell around this bullet, this missile. And we save them. In those days, we saved every shell to reuse. We're the state of Israel. We don't have Bill Gates' money, you know. So we saved them, and the officer told us that we could climb to the top of the water tower and we could face Syria. And we were going to make our own Chanukiah. And we took these shells and we climbed to the top of the water tower. We tied them. We filled them with sand and gasoline and oil and kerosene and everything there was. It's a miracle the water tower didn't burn down. We took old rags and we lit one night, two night, three night, dancing around the base. We light up the sky. This is a place where people weren't allowed to smoke. And we lit this huge bonfire, basically, at 20, you know, two stories high, facing the Syrians. And the morale was, it was unbelievable. The officer was almost court-martialed. He wasn't in the end, but he almost was. But we were just, to sing Yevanim, Yevanim, dancing around the base. Here we were, 2,000 years after the Syrian Greeks tried to destroy us. And here we were with Tzahal, in Hebrew, on our uniforms. Go ask your great-great-great-grandmother if she ever wanted to be near a soldier. The answer would be, of course, no. You see a soldier, you run the other way because they're probably trying to kill you. And yet here we were using machine guns that were developed in Israel. In those days, we didn't use the M16s they use today. They're called Galils or Glilones, developed in Israel. Sitting in tanks with technology that was developed in Israel, later copied by other armies. Facing those people who used to try to destroy us and are now trying to destroy us. And we're supposed to be dark and we lit up the sky to say, we are here. We are here to stay. They tried to kill us, they failed. and you're trying to kill us, you will fail also. It was, even today as I'm speaking, I get chills remembering that Hanukkah exposed to Syria. But we were not Yotzei the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles. It was too high, and it wasn't a wick, it was more of a torch. We weren't Yotzei. So we had to light our own candles. We had candles as part of our packs, but we didn't have a Chanukiah. That truck hadn't come yet. So we decided to do the following. I said that when a tank shoots out a missile, the shell comes back. The exact same thing happens with machine guns, but not on a huge scale, on a little scale. A little bullet gets shot out, and a little shell remains. And I was a gunner in the tank, one of my jobs. Doesn't sound very glamorous, but every time after maneuvers, every time after we shot, I had to go and collect those little shells. Sounds like a very glamorous job because they had to be recycled. I told this to an American guy that I know. He wasn't in tanks, but he shot. But he was in the American Army. He laughed. What do you mean you save those little things? Who saves them? When you're a Jewish soldier in a Jewish army, we're stuck. We don't have enough money. And so we save them. And part of my memories from the army is not just the sounds of the bullets going, and not just the smell of tank oil and gasoline and gunpowder, but it's also the sound of the tinkling of these shells coming off after you shoot them. And so what happened is you had many guns on the tank. One of the guns had bullets fed into the gun. Now they're fed by shells with links. Bullet, link, bullet, link, bullet, link. You with me? So they all they fed into the gun. The bullets go out. The shells and the links are shot out the other side. There was in those days a little thing to catch them. Didn't work so well. I had to go find them, separate the shells and the links. Well, here we were on Hanukkah, and here we were fighting the good fight. We didn't have a Chanukiah to fulfill the mitzvah. So what we decided to do was, myself and a couple other guys collected some shells, even though the bullets had been gone, they're empty now. And we put back the shells linked with more shells, and we made a Chanukiah out of those bullets. And we lit candles, l'hadlik ner, she'asa nisim la'avotenu, and it was priceless. Speaking of priceless, I brought that menorah here today to show you. This is a menorah that I've kept for many years. This is the menorah that we made on the Syrian border of 1987 Hanukkah. Now, you may notice that in those days we celebrated 16 days of Hanukkah. No, what happened was we realized early that the candles were too close together. So we needed to make bullets, the candles apart from each other. And so that's why it looks like it's more than eight. And I used this menorah every single day of Hanukkah that year. I have not used it since. I one time told this story in SAR, elementary school, and a person who was a curator for the Jewish Museum asked me if I wanted to donate it or lend it to the museum, and I said no. I don't know, maybe I'll say yes, I don't know. But it's very important to the family, and it reminds me of a time of my life where we try to fight the Yevanim and the Yevanim philosophy all the time, every day, not just Hanukkah. But this reminds me of a time in my life where I was able slightly, and I'm one of millions, and some of you have brothers who are doing it right now. Some of you have fathers who did it. Some of you have siblings, cousins, who do this fight and fight the fight. And not just the fight internally, but sometimes we've got to fight externally. We face that crisis. It's very, very hard. But it's better to face it than not face it. And this is a way for us, perhaps, to celebrate Hanukkah, to remember the fight, to remember the challenge, but also to remember the light that comes out when the fight is over. Hanukkah Sameach, everybody. You're welcome to come up and take a look.